The Monologue.
We dive in this hour of the Jason Rand Show, brought to you by You Build It, by looking at a reality in Washington State, in particular the Democrats. They have not talked about inflation. Have you noticed that? I mean, there was a time nationally that they wanted to pretend, Democrats, that there was no inflation going on whatsoever, which, of course, was a lie. But in Washington State in particular, we don't hear any of that. Inflation isn't real here, I guess. And they pretend it's not real because state law sets a minimum wage based on the consumer price index. That's why no one's talking about inflation. Now, Democrats are making the state more expensive to live in. They've got new tax after new tax after new tax on top of all of the other taxes that have been killing us. You're going to get hit with the Long-Term Care Trust Act in January. 58 cents for every $100 that you earn goes into this awful life insurance plan. You're going to get hit potentially with the capital gains tax. And that, of course, means income tax is coming. But then you've got inflation, which, of course, makes things worse. Democrats pretended it wasn't happening. And they continue to pretend it's not happening because they have reason to. When prices of goods go up, so does the minimum wage in Washington State. That, according to the law, the 2021 minimum wage in Washington State will be $14.49. That's a little bit more than a 5% increase on what it is now. And of course, it doesn't take into account the rise of business costs. When the cost of consumer goods go up, also means the cost of the products that the businesses are purchasing to sell you go up. And we already know about all of the problems getting into this country those products. The pipeline has been stalled, in large part due to COVID, which is causing even more problems, the shortage of goods. But what this ends up meaning is that these businesses are going to get hit with a 5% increase during a pandemic on staff that they already are struggling to take on these open jobs. And what it ultimately means in Washington State are those small and mid-sized cities from Kelso to Chelan, Sultan to Pasco, they're all going to have to deal with now the pandemic slowdown, the rising cost of goods, and higher wages. And they're doing it all at once. And no one seems to care. No one seems to care. Instead, they go, they're working in Seattle. Look at those small businesses thriving. When, of course, those small businesses are not thriving. Many of them have gone out of business. Over 200 businesses have closed their doors forever. Some of the large companies are struggling. Boeing, for example, struggling. And they're not even going to be impacted by this, except for the janitorial jobs, maybe. You're telling people at the worst possible time that you're going to make their jobs even harder. And when you're a business owner, you ultimately have one job, which is to keep the doors open. Stay in business. That's your ultimate job. All while we still have businesses getting hit with other taxes that are to come. And then, of course, people will get hit with additional taxes, despite the fact that they would get higher wages. It is so very clear what is going on in this state, and no one wants to talk about it. No one wants to talk about it. Think to yourself for just one moment, why is that?
The interview.
So good news for those of you who are sick and tired of the divisive nature of Socialist Councilwoman Shama Sawant of Seattle. The recall has been certified, and it will go to a vote in the winter. So now what? It is one thing to get a percentage of the district to sign on to a recall. How do you convince now the majority of the voters to say yes to the recall? Joining me on the line is the man who made this all happen, one of the men who made this all happen, Henry Bridger, campaign manager and chair of the Recall Sawant campaign. Henry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for having me.
So, now what? Because it's going to get ugly.
Now what? Okay, that's a loaded question. Well, we finally got certified, and that was a really rough road to travel, and with many, many delays on Sawant's part to delay it as much as she could to stay in office longer. But we finally succeeded, and now we're waiting for our election date, which is December 7th. So we're looking forward to having that take place very soon.
How heavy will you be actually promoting the recall versus just stepping back and now letting the voters decide?
Oh, we're going to be very heavily involved in getting out the vote. She has got her army of Swantonistas out there knocking on doors already. They've been knocking on doors since we turned in the petitions, and they've been knocking on they actually knocked on our campaign assistant's door in Central District last week. I actually got a phone call. They didn't know it was me, trying to get me to vote against the recall. Sorry, but that's not going to happen.
Yeah, no kidding. And what you've seen in the past is they've been pretty aggressive.
Yes, very aggressive. They've been aggressive even with even the constituents of the district. They'll damage the property. They'll do all kinds of things to get you to not do something. But we decided not to be bullied. And I think it's now time for her to face her constituents that she does not represent. And I think it'll be a big turnout, even though she says it's going to be voter suppression. That's not going to be happening.
Well, in fairness to her, she always will pull some sort of stunt so that if she wins, she can say, the movement overcame the rich Amazon folks or the right-wingers who are pushing this. And if she loses, she has an actual excuse rather than to take any sort of responsibility for the role that she played in all of this. Where do you think voters are ultimately going to go, given, you know, there was reason to believe she was going to lose re-election, and then Amazon stepped in and it hurt her progressive opponent, who virtually would side with her on most of the issues, but because of the Amazon connection, they decided to ditch him and vote for her?
I feel certain that the district here is going to step up and hold her accountable for everything she's done. I think, one, the voters here realize that they just sat around and let this happen for three elections for the last 7 years. And I think they're now realizing, oh, we need to fix this. And I think they're getting the pressure from other Seattleites outside of the district to get this done. And we're getting a lot of support within Seattle and a lot of support within the district, much, much different than what she's getting from outside of the state, who wants to influence our policy, our politics.
Do you think she's going to be able to convince people come the actual election day here or the recall date here that it's the right wingers who are responsible for all of this?
No, because there aren't right wingers don't exist in this district or this city. It's like Brandy Cruz. She had a commentary that she did on there is no such thing as right wingers in Seattle, and there really isn't. I mean, it's really rare, and she's just blathering, and I don't think they're buying it any longer. Yes, she's progressive. Yes, we're progressive. I'm progressive. I'm just not in lockstep with some of the things she is pushing because they're things that just can't happen. That just won't happen. They're just pipe dreams. Mm-hmm. And she's just filling the heads of her followers with things that I don't think they really work.
They definitely don't. If anyone wants to get involved and help this campaign out, SawantRecall.org is the place to go. SawantRecall.org. At this point, we're just waiting for the date for the recall election to take place. And of course, Henry, we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Jason.
Absolutely.
Feel free to call me anytime.
That, again, is Henry Bridger from the Recall Shama Sawant campaign. Their website, SawantRecall.org. Now this.
The interview.
The truly awful idea of dismantling the Minneapolis Police Department will not go away. There's a push to replace the city's police department with a new Department of Public Safety. Former Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanek joins me now to discuss. Sheriff, welcome to the show.
Jason, thanks for having me on.
Where do things stand exactly? A judge said no to voting on the concept, and now I guess the council's taking it up anyway?
Well, judge said yes, someone else said no, judge said yes, someone else said no, and then the Supreme Court said, put it on the ballot. So now we're on the ballot for November 2. We're about 3 weeks into mail-in early voting, and about 3 weeks or so to go to the final vote.
I covered this story originally before the judge had ruled on Fox News, and I had taken the position that, you know what, vote on it. At some point, the voters do have to step up and make a decision. They either want to dismantle the police department or they don't. Why not just have them vote?
Well, that's great. That's a great question, but keep in mind that, this whole controversy has really been about one segment of the population says, hey, we want police reform. Another one says abolish and defund. Another one says, wait a minute, the question on the ballot itself is misleading. What the ballot says now is that they will delete the Minneapolis Police Department, abolish it and defund it, and replace it with a Department of Public Safety. The problem is there are guarantees in the current language that's in place, which guarantees a number of sworn officers, 1.7 per 1,000 residents, and guarantees a certain amount of funding.
Mm-hmm.
Once that's gone, city council can do as they wish. And the second part of this is that it moves from a strong mayor system in which the mayor appoints the chief of police, and the chief of police works for the mayor and the residents of the city, and now replaces it with 13 new bosses called the 13 council members. And, when everybody's in charge, no one's in charge, Jason.
Well, in fairness, when everyone's in charge who all thinks the same and it's an echo chamber, it does mix it up just a little bit, but your point is well taken. It is a horrible idea. It's one that, if it were to be established, it would destroy the city of Minneapolis. But I suppose I still take the same position. The people of Minneapolis now have to stand up. Right. I come from a city that I say the exact same thing to people. We have right now a Seattle city attorney who campaigned that candidate won the primary. She is a police and prison abolitionist who says she's not going to prosecute crimes. OK, you know what? If that's the decision the voters want to go in, go for it. Put it on record. Live with the consequences. Because sometimes you do have to hit rock bottom before you realize the damage that you're doing to yourself and to others. Maybe that's what Minneapolis has to be. My sense is there is this anxiety, of which I share, that the voters do want this. And it'll create momentum in other places.
It's interesting because about, in early polling, it was about a 50-50 proposition. People wanted it. People didn't want it. What was interesting, though, is that they were saying that the communities of color are the ones that wanted to abolish and defund the police. Yet 75% people of color say, no, we actually want more police officers. With this ballot initiative, we will not get more police officers. They will abolish and defund. And what happens in Minneapolis, this is just a test case. This is the blueprint for the rest of the country. It will happen in a major city near you very soon. Portland, L.A., New
Absolutely.
York, Chicago, you name it. And, with all fairness, these 13 council members have no plan. This thing will go into effect 30 days after November 2nd, right? So about December 2nd or 3rd. This goes into effect, whereas there is no more Minneapolis Police Department. There's a Department of Public Safety. Lo and behold, wouldn't surprise you, these 13 have not even come up with an idea about what a Department of Public Safety would look like.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't told the voters or the residents anything.
Yeah.
They deserve better. In the meantime, our violent crime skyrockets.
Yep.
Our murder rates are up 78, 79%. gunshots, gunshot victims are up 45-50%. It is chaos, and the only ones that are winning at the end of the day are the bad guys and women, because there's some women out there mm-hmm. who want to do us harm. And that's not fair to the police. It's not fair to the residents of the city.
It's not. You're 100% correct. And you know what? If this were to pass, you're right. It would create a whole bunch of momentum. But the opposite is also true. If it doesn't pass, it kills momentum on this. And that's what I'm hoping will happen. Again, I have anxiety about all of these votes, whether it's in Minneapolis or here in Seattle. But at some point, people need to just go on the record. And it seems like this is the most obvious horrible idea that one could potentially come up with for policing, and the people need to speak clearly, loudly and clearly, that they don't want it. If they want it, they're going to live with the consequences, and unfortunately, that means even more crime. We've been talking with former Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanek. Sheriff, thank you so much for stopping by and weighing in on this. I really appreciate it.
Jason, can I tell you just one more thing
of course.
Really caught my attention? And I've been a cop for 36 years. I'm a Minneapolis police officer for nearly 25 years and the sheriff of that county, Hennepin County, for the last 12. And I've been working with this group, fightforheroes.com, which will, you know, tell people what this is and what this isn't. But what really got my attention was when I saw the amount of money that was going in to support and pass this abolish and defund the Minneapolis Police Department. Over $1 million, maybe $1.5 million, and yet only 15% of those monies were coming in from residents of the city of Minneapolis. That means that 85% or so from outside. What does that tell you at the end of the day? Or does that lend credence to when I say this is just the blueprint? This is just a test case. It's coming to a major U.S. city near you in the near future.
100%, and that it happens in Minnesota is interesting, right? Because it's not happening necessarily, not this way in Seattle or Portland or New York, where you kind of would expect more of that kind of stuff to happen. It's happening in Minneapolis. They're obviously taking advantage of recent news, but that's the way it goes. And that's an unfortunate reality that we live in right now. It truly is. I hope the voters there wise up just very quickly. Do you think they're going to see through this?
You know, I am hopeful that the voters of Minneapolis will vote no. I agree with you. Put it on the ballot if they so wish. Just be honest and candid. They've done the best job they can through the courts in terms of the language. But now it's about educating the residents of Minneapolis. I believe the ballot initiative will be defeated. I think the police officers deserve better than what their elected officials are giving them. And I honestly believe, as a lifelong resident and born and raised in Minneapolis, that those residents deserve so much more better than the violent crime that's been happening.
I agree with you. I hope the voters make the right move, unless the city is filled with people who hold crazier views than you and I assume they do. But we'll see how it goes. Hennepin County Sheriff, Sheriff Rich Stanek, thank you so much for giving us your perspective on this. I really do appreciate it. Keep up the fight.
Thanks, Jason.
Absolutely. Bye-bye. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show. Now this.
The Jason Rant Show.
Always glad to see Seattle radio host Jason Rantz.
It's always a pleasure to watch you and a pleasure now to host you.
Jason, I just love your coverage of what's been going on in Seattle.
Jason, this is as bad as it gets in America.
Jason Rantz, great to see you. Thank you.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
Although the media isn't focusing too much attention on it, it's one of the most important issues facing Washington State right now and really facing the voters. We've been talking about on this show the new congressional maps and legislative maps that are being drawn as a result of the new census data. And Democrats have put out proposals that would gut the ability of Republicans to really ever gain any kind of control in the House. And now we've got congressional maps out that don't necessarily make sense. Joining me on the line is one of the Republicans who's doing his best to actually make competitive races, not unfair races, but competitive races, Redistricting Commissioner Paul Graves. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on again.
So the latest news since we last talked about this issue is that the congressional maps have come out. The Republicans, you guys have put out your proposals. Democrats have put out theirs. What does it look like?
There's the biggest difference on both legislative and congressional side between Democrats and Republicans is how many swing districts there are. You can use different metrics for it. We use an average of the 2020 statewide races other than lieutenant governor because it had two Democrats. If you use that number and you overlay it over the districts we've drawn, on the legislative side, me and my Republican counterpart in the Senate have drawn 11 and 10 swing districts out of 49. Our Democratic counterparts have each drawn three. So only three of the 49 legislative districts would be competitive any given year. On the congressional side, it's even worse. Right now, we only have one competitive district. Mine draws two, and one of them is within about 0.5% of being competitive. Both of our Democratic counterparts draw zero swing districts out of our 10. In other words, every single congressional race will be decided before voters even have a chance to vote.
Yeah, and this was, of course, done intentionally. They went over the top intentionally. You did something a little bit more pragmatic, and arguably you were a little bit too moderate in your approach in trying to do this fairly, right? I mean, people can look at this and say, why didn't you guys get a little bit more aggressive in some of this? Now, some of it is demographic. You can't really get that aggressive in Washington State. But do you regret not being a little bit more underhanded the way the Democrats are being?
You know, it's funny. I'm not even sure I would call them underhanded. We all have our roles to play here. Across the country, anytime the majority party has, you know, current majorities, they're going to want to draw zero competitive districts. You just lock in all the race of the districts as they are, and that's how you go. And the minority party that we are in this state right now wants to draw more competitive districts. So in one sense, we're all playing the hands that we're dealt. But at the end of the day, there are just four of us, and we have this great bipartisan commission in Washington State. Three of us have to approve a map, two Republicans, two Democrats, and there are different strategies for how you might do your initial maps. But me, ultimately, at the end of the day, the biggest thing I care about is having a lot of swing districts, giving voters a lot of choices in their elections. And I just that's what I focused on in the maps that I drew, and that's what I'm going to be my focus on negotiations. And there are different ways of doing it, but I think just being really straightforward about this is the bottom line thing that I care about, and here's what I would like it to look like, is the right strategy.
Absolutely. And everyone wins when you have a competitive district, because even if it's still going to go to a progressive in Seattle, making it slightly more more competitive in some of these areas just means that the incumbent or the progressive has to up their game a little bit, that it's just not an automatic seat in Congress or seat in Olympia. So where do things stand moving forward? I'm going to assume neither you nor your Republican counterpart on the commission, Joe Fain, will be saying just, oh yeah, cool, we'll thumbs up to the Democrats. So where do things go right now?
That's fair. I have a hunch that my Democratic friends on our commission will probably not just say thumb up to ours. We have 6 weeks now. We have until November 15th to approve maps. Again, we have to have three out of the four votes to approve the maps. And we are beginning negotiations in earnest. We got our data late. We were supposed to get the data from the Fed in April. We got it in August. So that's why it's taken so long to get here. But I'll be operating in entire good faith. I hope my Democratic friends will be as well. And, you know, again, we have 6 weeks between now and then. We're hosting a couple of public outreach sessions, but really our main focus is going to be trying to negotiate in earnest between now and November 15th to get to maps that are fair for Washington and, in my view, give Washingtonians a lot of choices in their elections.
Now, the website for folks to actually look at the calendar, look at the districts and make sure they add to their calendars when to attend a public hearing or participate in a public hearing, it's redistricting.wa.gov, redistricting.wa.gov. People should go there right now. We're talking with one of the Republican-appointed commissioners to the committee, Redistricting Commissioner Paul Graves. What is it like behind the scenes with some of the negotiating when these are also public negotiations, right?
They're sort of.
To a degree.
There are four of us on the commission. Yeah, so any two of us can talk to each other, and I think the way we're structuring it is that we're doing it in pairs like that and reaching at least some rough general agreements on things before we all come together and approve plans. And I think in those meetings, it's going to be exactly what you might imagine. We're going to have a map of the state on a big projector board. And we're going to be clicking around using census block tracks, the smallest grouping of people that the census does. And we're going to be saying, here's this district, here's where the current lines are, or here's where our proposed current lines are. Let's start negotiating which actual blocks are included and which are not to get to the population that we need for each district.
Where is their general agreement?
Oh, we have to have the same population.
But I mean, right. I mean, right now, before you know, before going into these final stretches, I mean, I'm assuming that for the most part, when you look at District 7, which includes Seattle, the question becomes, where do you draw those lines? Do you make it a little bit tighter, or do you expand it? Democrats would love, obviously, to have it expanded. You preferably would not like to have it expanded. So where are there some just general agreements?
I'd say there are parts of the state. So again, I want to have competitive elections. There's some parts of the state where you can't do that, and you know the voters there wouldn't want that. Like you're not going to draw a competitive district in Capitol Hill, and you're not going to draw a competitive district in Selah. And so in those areas of the world, there might be more general agreement where because it's less partisan because you know the Capitol Hill district is going to be Democratic and the Selah district is going to be Republican. There's less of the partisan fight there, and there's more sort of a just a good government. What are the communities here? Which communities should remain together? That kind of a thing. I think that's probably the biggest place of our agreement and then the biggest areas of our disagreement are just how many districts will be competitive and how many will not.
At the end of the day, if you do not come to an agreement, it then goes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court presumably can do one of a few things, but most likely they either just, it's my understanding, they would just pick one of the districts and decide on their own or get some sort of nonpartisan expert to just look at the demographics and decide that way?
That's my hunch. The latter is my understanding of how it would probably go. They probably wouldn't just pick one of our four. They would probably retain a geographic information system person from like UW or WSU who would do some advising, and then they would take our maps sort of into account. I imagine we'd have a chance to make our case for various things that we care about, and then they would go approve the map.
Is that a good result from your perspective if you're not able to negotiate successfully with the Democrats?
It's certainly not the best result. I'd rather use it.
Yeah, you'd rather your maps.
Yeah, exactly. But I wouldn't want it to go there. But if it goes there, each side faces tremendous risk. I mean, it's more of a left leaning court, so on the partisan side, Republicans have more of a concern. But on the personal incumbent side, there are a lot more Democrats, and they tend to live in dense districts right close to their lines. And I have a hunch the Supreme Court is not going to know or care where any of them live. So a number of current incumbents would be at a substantial risk of being drawn into a new district. And so I think both parties face pretty substantial risk in going to the Supreme Court, and I'm hoping that that mutual risk drives us to an agreement.
And you're referring in that case to the legislative level. You're not talking about congressional, right? Because as we know...
Well, did you know that Adam Smith, Kim Schreier, and Susan Del Bene all live within 11 miles of each other?
Yeah. I did know that. That's why I asked. So, and Pramila Jayapal, when she ran, didn't live in her district.
That's right. You don't have to on the congressional side, but you actually have to kind of gerrymander things to keep all three of those incumbent Democratic Congress members in their current district.
Oh, fun
and
times.
I have a hunch that the state Supreme Court's not going to care about that.
Yeah, probably not. Redistricting.wa.gov, get on the record, because they do end up looking at this if it were to go to the state Supreme Court side. And, of course, obviously the commissioners are looking at this as well. Redistricting.wa.gov. We've been talking with one of the Republicans on the commission, Paul Graves. Thank you so much for stopping by, as always. Really do appreciate it.
Thanks, as always, Jason.
Absolutely. Again, redistricting.wa.gov. Please, please, please go there right now and find a way to participate. It is incredibly important. Redistricting.wa.gov. Now this.
The Jason Rant Show.
Jason Rant, Seattle radio host, joins us now.
Jason, you're the perfect guest on this.
Jason Rant, welcome back, Jason.
I see you often on other programs here.
Jason, what's going on?
Jason, thanks for coming on.
The Quick Hit.
You know, when you've lost Sonny Hostin, as a Democrat, you really, really, truly have screwed up something. When you've lost her, you have screwed something up. And Democrats overplayed their hand yesterday when talking about abortion. You had members of the House get together in a committee hearing to share their personal abortion stories. They're doing this in response to the Texas law. They're trying to put pressure on, I guess, lawmakers, but really courts in Texas and ultimately the Supreme Court to overturn the Texas law. Now, the Texas law is almost certainly going to be overturned. It is, while it is clever, it is almost certainly unconstitutional, and that's from someone who's pro-life saying that. I don't like the idea of someone who was not personally harmed to have a cause of action, and that's what it ends up doing, even though the cause itself is worthy to me. But you had various members of the House testify about their abortions, and they did this because they wanted to humanize the specific medical procedure or healthcare procedure, in their view, so that people could have an emotional reaction and understand that, you know, you'd be hurting women like them if you were to allow these kinds of laws, not just Texas, but other laws across the state, to move forward. Now, Pramila Jayapal, the Seattle congresswoman, was one of the congresswomen who spoke out. And she had taken the position that she had an abortion based on a previous risky birth.
Whether the choice to have an abortion is easy or hard, whether there are traumatic situations or not, none of that should be the issue. It is simply nobody's business what choices we as pregnant people make about our own bodies.
But it is everyone's business about their vaccine choices, by the way. A vaccine choice is her business, and you're mandated into that medical decision. But when it comes to taking of an innocent life in an abortion versus the less than 1% chance of death due to COVID, when really, by the way, the person who would be at risk is someone who's choosing themselves not to be vaccinated, that's a different story.
And let me be clear. I would never tell people who don't choose to have an abortion that they should do so. Nor should they tell me that I shouldn't.
However, of course, since you've had a vaccine, you're telling others that they should get a vaccine. In that case, it's different.
And let me be clear. I would never tell people who don't choose to have an abortion.
I just want to make sure I understood this. Continue.
That they should do so.
Okay.
Nor should they tell me that I shouldn't.
Okay. So beyond then the inconsistencies in logic here, vaccine versus abortion, she and others shared specific details of the abortions that they went through. And for Sunny Hostin over at The View, she said, no, that was kind of cringy.
I don't think that that testimony is going to change anyone's minds. I was sort of cringing at it because I do think it's so personal. As everyone knows, I think that life begins at conception. And I just kept on thinking about the fact that babies were aborted. And I wasn't convinced by anything that was said. And I don't think anyone would be. So I didn't really like the fact that they were sharing that personal information, even though I understand why they did.
And that is a reasonable and actually, you know, logical conclusion for Sunny Hostin to make, which is why I was so shocked she made it, even though she is technically she's pro-choice, I believe, but she believes abortion is wrong. She views it obviously as murder. She's not going to say it in those words there. But when you say life begins at conception, then of course you view this as the taking of a life. And that's really what this is about. People can go ahead and shout their abortion, as the Twitter movement said, all they want. It's not going to change someone's view if you believe this is taking of a life. That's all that this is about for folks who are pro-life. That's it. And there seems to be this general misunderstanding of where the pro-life movement comes from, which is in part why you get some of these movements, but other times, and I think Pramila Jayapal is a good example of this, I think all the House members are a good example of this, they are purposefully misleading you about what pro-lifers believe. And you know this if you are pro-life. That this is about the life. This isn't about access to health care. The folks on the left want to pretend that the pro-lifers just hate women. They want to force women into back alley abortions because they hate women that much. That's not what this is about at all. I'm someone who, and I'm consistent on this, I have no clue in the world where life begins. I do not know. And so I err on the side of caution of life and say that it starts at conception. I don't know. I can't prove it. People pretend that they can prove it. They can't. I don't know when it begins. However, because I don't know it, I'm going to just err on the side of life out of caution, out of respect for life. Now, I understand why folks on the left don't hold that position. I get it. I get it. That's why I don't try to argue on this issue beyond their position here. It's an either or. You either believe it, you either begin life begins at conception or you don't. Whichever side you want to take, I'm fine with, but I will certainly debate that specific argument. And I'll point out that they have no clue when life begins. The difference is they don't want to argue that because they can't win that argument. They can't deceive people with that argument. So instead, what do? They just make up a whole bunch of stuff about the motives of folks who are pro-life.
The Last Rants.
I want to leave you going into the weekend with some personal news. I was diagnosed yesterday with central serous retinopathy. Retinopathy. It's basically the swelling of the retina. I will be okay, by the way. I mean, I hope I will. I'm told I will be. But the more the doctor told me about what was going on, the more angry I was getting. I was starting to get pissed. It's called central serous retinopathy, and it impacts mostly men in their 30s or 40s with type A personalities who work hard. And so it's like my eye is punishing me for working hard. It's like this disease came from a lab somewhere in Capitol Hill, created by millennials, to hurt people who actually work hard, unlike them. It's not necessarily stress related. It is type A personality related. And type A personalities are the ones who are the go-getters, I suppose. And so what this means is my left eye has this tiny circle. It's kind of it's actually technically in the lower left half of my left eye, but the way I see it, because of the way that the eye works, it's in the upper left corner of my eye. It's a small kind of circle that's blurry, as if I'm looking through a droplet of water. And then when I close my eye, it kind of looks like I'm seeing an eclipse, or like when you stare into a light bulb for too long, the imprint is still there. That's what it kind of looks like. Now, I haven't hit any of the other symptoms, which could make it look like a dark spot in the center of the vision. I don't have that. Objects appear further away. I don't have that. But I do have the lines appear crooked. Like if I'm looking at lines and I'm looking at it through this one portion, it's kind of like peripheral vision in a way, because when I'm looking straight ahead, I don't see it straight ahead. I see it in the periphery. And so it supposedly goes away on its own. If it doesn't, you have to get like an injection into the retina, which I'm hoping I don't have to do. I have to see a specialist now in a couple of weeks. My doctor doesn't think it's serious. I'm not going to go blind or anything. But the more I thought about this, the more I was pissed off. And you know what? I'm supposed to probably take it easy this weekend, because of my retina that's all swollen and stuff. And you can't see it, by the way. It's just, I'm the only one who can see it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to let some stupid disease or some stupid eye issue stop me from working on some pretty big stories that we have ready for you next week. And I know you're going to love them. And that's the last rants. Just me being angry ahead of the weekend, which is actually always the case emotionally for me. And not just for the weekend, every day. I leave angry.